Welcome to the Tin Biscuit Podcast. Today we've got a new guest, that is Sean Woods. Cheers for coming on, Sean.
No problem.
Thanks. So, you're a boxing coach.
Was a boxing coach.
Was, but now you own a gym. So what age did you start getting into boxing?
My dad got me into boxing at the age of 7. I remember I was at Barcroft Junior School. I got into a stupid little fight, and when I got home, he asked me if I wanted to go boxing. So he contacted a friend that he used to coach, because my dad used to run a gym years ago with his brothers, a guy called Terry Baker, and a guy called Buddy Rayworth. From the age of 7 till I was a teenager, used to pick me up and take me to, which is now the Steakhouse, I believe. Smokehouse, sorry.
All right.
It was the White Hart at the time, and there was a little room up there, and that was my first experience of a boxing gym.
So, like, what age was you about when you started boxing?
Well, I was 7. To be fair, with a club, it wasn't structured too well for kids, so it was kids with adults. I walked into the gym and I watched two blokes sparring with each other, which was quite, I thought, was amazing. These two meatheads were tattoos. They had guards on, but they was like punching each other in the face, and I was impressed. Just a little 7-year-old.
Right, cool. So, like, where did your boxing go from there? Was it, did it something you took to? Was, like, obviously you, was you a natural?
No. I won't say that. I'd say the opposite. Boxing had a bit of a bad effect on me as a kid, because although I gained confidence within the gym, because people heard that I'd done boxing, I sort of lost confidence out of the gym. Mm. I never really wanted to go nowhere with my boxing. My dad encouraged it, though, but I wanted to join the Royal Marines, so I went in the Sea Cadets.
All right.
But unfortunately, I was a bit of a rogue, and I got kicked out of the Sea Cadets, so I thought, if I'm going to get kicked out of the Cadets, I ain't got a chance in the actual Marines.
What did you get kicked out for?
They had a power bout, and one Sunday, me and me mate, who's dead now actually, good laugh, we decided to go and steal it, and we went out in the docks, and we didn't think nobody would see us, so we was at parade the next week, and all of a sudden the CO said, we've got some clowns who think they can set the power bout out. And he told us to hand ourselves in. We did, and I got kicked out. So, I mean, I can laugh about it now, because it was just boisterous, but it was a bit upsetting at the time.
So, but like, sort of, yeah. So, do it semi-professional?
No.
Did you go into competitions when you was that
at age? That time, I went back boxing, and it just happened to be that I was about 15, that there was a group of seniors, and there was a boxer called Albert Cole, Brian Dawn, Tim Robinson, and Rick North. They was like the seniors of Grimsby ABC.
All right.
And they all decided to go pro, but they all went in different areas. Mm-hmm. I befriended Rick North, which was very strange, because when I was a kid, I was mischievous. I used to let his tyres down when he was second the sessions, because he was strict with us. we just become friends, and he decided to join the Winkerbank gym in Sheffield.
Right.
At the time, he was famous for having our bomber Graham. There was a young Nasir Mohamed that used to use the gym, but although everyone used to rave on about how good he was and what he was going to achieve, I didn't have a clue at the time, because he just looked like a 17-year-old with a side. Yeah, pretty much.
Side sweep here,
and he didn't look anything extraordinary, but obviously he was.
So, we, like, sort of, what boxers did, like, you look up to when, like, you was sort of 15?
Well, it was pretty strange, really, because obviously you look up to the big guys that's on Sky. I was always a massive fan of Chris Eubanks.
Yeah.
Everyone around me hated him. I mean, it was like, me and a friend called Matty McCall, he's a local doorman, me and him went to Old Trafford to watch Nigel Benn and Eubank 2, yeah. The one that was a draw. And he was a devout Benn fan, and I was like, I was cheering for Eubank, because I was a big fan. But locally, because Rick North was a bit older, I had a bit of a big brother complex with him. That
sort of someone took up to.
Yeah, but I was a massive fan, really big fan of a Hull boxer called Tony Booth. He was, he just never used to train for his fights. He was a super middleweight tops. And I'd just seen him go in the ring with heavyweights and play with them. He went in with David A, Derek Jova, is that his name? I forget. He obviously never played with them, but he shouldn't have been in the ring with them getting a payday. But I see him going with some talented lads, and he just played with them. And there's even footage of him on YouTube where the crowd are shouting, "You, FB," and he starts doing the alley shuffle to him, turns around and sparks his opponent out.
Does it? Really?
Yeah, and I've seen him do that a few times. So he used to box at the Winter Games. I was a big fan.
Was he? So did like you ever go into competitions?
I boxed for Grimsby ABC. I had about 8 or 9 fights. But when I went over to Winkerbank, I sort of see the difference between a club that opens 3 times a week for 1.5 hours that's made up basically of circuit training, to a full-time gym that's open 2 times a day, in the morning before school or work, and in the afternoon after work, 7 days a week, and there was no circuit training to be seen. It was all skill, it was all footwork, it was combination punching, and it put me off the sport because I thought, you're never going to do anything in this town unless you travel. And I never read that. So from then, I started working security, as in the doors.
Right.
And majority of the doorman was...
What age was you when you started doing door work?
I was 17 when I first started working the door.
Really?
Yeah. That was my first job. A guy called Pete Reed got me it. I went into bar work, and because I was still young, but I got offered a job at Baker Street when I was 19, and I worked there. Hi, lads, you're right. It was still there. I was still young to do the job, and I really wish that I'd not done it, because I was very young. There's a lot of people there to challenge you. I wasn't mature enough to let it go over my head. So if there was a confrontation there, unfortunately, I landed in the confrontation.
Yeah.
But it was from then the majority of the doormen, there was all bodybuilders, they wanted to learn about boxing. So that was how I started coaching, because I was helping mates that was working the door. I was doing it like in the gym with them. I was showing them stuff. And then from there, I opened a club called Mariners Amateur Boxing Club.
Right, now, how old was you when you did that? Was you still 19?
Oh, no. I was about 22, 23 then. Still very young for a coach, but yeah. Because of my own reasons, I didn't really want to box, because I wanted to give the town a gym that I would have boxed in. You know, yeah. That was made up of a very similar training to Brendan Ingle style at Winkerbank. And like I say, he covered a lot of areas. I mean, this one time I was doing pads with him, and I said to him, "Oh, Brendan, we do some pads with me?" And he said, "Yeah, all right then." And I said, "Oh, can we do it down there?" And he said to me, "Why down there?" And there was Nazim Amri talking.
Pull your mic up a bit, please, Sean. Cheers,
my dude. And there was Nazim Amri talking to a biographer.
Yeah.
And there was Johnny Nelson talking to a national paper. So obviously, I didn't want to do pads in front of them.
Yeah.
So he told me to get me gloves on. I got me gloves on, and he got me doing this coordination work. I was terrible. I couldn't do it. But I've seen a lot of people on telly do it, and they couldn't do it the first time. So anyway, he went to me, "Get in the ring." So I was like, "Yeah, okay." So I jumped in the ring. It was like a stage then, and I'm stood in the middle of the ring, and there's people looking at me. And it was like a big competition ring, big 20 foot, 4 foot off the ground, or 3 foot. So Brendan Ingle went to me, "Sing me a song then." And I went, "What?" And he went, "Sing me a song." I was like, "I'm not going to sing you a song." And he went, "Well, if you don't do as you're told, I can't really train you then, can I? You might as well go home." So I thought, oh my God, I'm all the way in Sheffield. And so for some silly reason, Old MacDonald come to mind for my first song. So I started singing on MacDonald in the most sheepish way going. Sheepish way, yeah. And I'm like sort of mumbling on MacDonald, because I'm obviously shy, I feel stupid. So anyway, I could have kissed him, because he stopped me before I got to the band noises. So he started singing. And I thought, right, okay, brilliant. And I thought, it's even more awkward. So then he got a young lad in who was a minority, and he went, "Oh, I sing us a song," and he just started rapping a song out like it was nothing.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought, he's not going to do that to me again. So I was in town on a Monday night, and it was karaoke night. So I thought, I went out with a few female friends that I knew, and we started using the karaoke, obviously after a few beers. I started singing the song Daydream Believer. And the more and more that I got up and sung in front of someone, I got it. I got that a lot of fighters get stage fright. And then he got me again, but we was in a car this time, and there was former British champion Jonathan Faxton, there was Rick North going to a fight, and there was a big heavyweight prospect called Pelly Reed from Birmingham.
Right.
So he said to me, go on then, Sean, sing us a song. So I starts blating out Daydream Believer. But Pelly Reed's looking at me just saying, bro. So anyway, I thought, I did it. Brendan Ingle said, that was crap. That was fine. And then he turned around to Pelly Reed and went, go on then, Pelly, sing us a song. He went, bro. He went, sing us a song. And he went, bum, bum, bum.
Did
it. Yeah, well, then that's what he did. So everyone burst out laughing, but Brendan was like, you've been racist. But that was an experience that nobody in this town would put next to boxing.
Yeah.
And it's like, there was a rival gym that was heaving, and you'd pay your subs and he'd take you for a run. That was unheard of. Brendan was like, if you're going to run, you do it in your own time. You don't. It's not part of your boxing session. And then slowly but surely, you'd see the lads adopt the coach's mannerisms and his style of a shaved head, and they'd all walk the same, and it was very funny to watch.
It progressed through.
Yeah, and it was I put that down as to a lot of insecurity, in the looking up to like a role model, which
you're trying to emulate him.
Yeah, but it doesn't help you when you're in the boxing ring.
No.
And a clever kid said to me once, when you're in the boxing ring, there's only one man that can help you, and it's the ref, and if he has, he stopped the fight, you've lost. So all of that means nothing in the ring. So I learnt that. So whatever I taught in my gym, it was to do with what was going on in the ring, not how to walk about outside the ring and conduct yourself. So I had two students. I had four lads who fought for me, but I had two serious students at the Mariners ABC. I had Andy Cox and I had Kev Hooper.
Right.
So anyway, I slipped out of the boxing gym scene. My dad fell ill, so I put my concentration in other areas. And unfortunately, whilst out one night, a lad of Sri Lankan ethnicity, is that the word?
Not yet, you can say that.
Yeah, he decided to attack me with a glass. So
right.
I got glassed around the side of the head. Never seen the kid before.
Was there a reason he did that? Or?
It was to do with one of his party. I fell in the pier, drunk as usual, and got shoved back. And then next thing I know, I just got a glass around the side of the face.
Right.
So he got arrested for it, the kid did. And I wasn't one for going to the police, but I told the truth that I couldn't remember a thing. But I got accused of being a racist because the kid was an ethnic. I don't know what I said or did to be racist other than take the glass around the face. But yeah. So anyway, he got found not guilty, the kid, and then it turned out that the lad was from London and he was down here doing a lot of credit card fraud, him and his gang, shall I say. Mm-hmm. And he was involved in a stabbing of another doorman, which nearly killed the kid.
Was that in town?
No, that was Cleethorpes. So he hit him with a samurai sword and stabbed him in he lost half his liver. And he paralysed his arm. He pleaded guilty to that, but for some reason never went to jail. Again, it was a racist attack.
Didn't get put to jail for chopping someone's liver out?
It was actually half his liver that he lost. It was a guy called Paul Lee.
Right.
We're not the best of mates, but we've become friends through the incident. I got a glass around the face and he stabbed him. But again, if anybody could use a race card, it was really bad back then. I mean, you're talking about the grooming gangs, etc.
Yeah.
So if someone was going out stabbing somebody, they was getting away with it. So anyway, from then, that was going to change my life, because a few mutual friends between him and me were saying we should check hands and it should be over with. I didn't want to carry a beef on with the kid, but I didn't want to be his friend.
Yeah.
He sounded like a right nasty piece of work. So one night whilst at the Winter Gardens, he turned up there with a car full of lads. There was hammers and knives in the back of the car, and they turned up to get me. Outside the Winter Gardens, there was a commotion. Lucky for me, I got stabbed, but it was only on the forearm. People come out the Winter Gardens and gave chase to these gang of lads. The hammers was all found in the car, and the Sri Lankan himself, he got caught and somebody stamped on his head. It was a guy called Jamie Drinkley. Still comes forward to it to this day.
Yeah.
I mean, that was back in 2002, now we're in 2018, and today he still admits that he did it. They arrested me for it. A police officer that I knew, called Graham Spencer, he was in the army with my godchildren's dad, and he'd also had a confrontation with a Sri Lankan, where he felt the Sri Lankan was going to bottle him. But the doorman at Park Lane stopped it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that really changed my life. So Graham Spencer interviewed me, and he put it to me that things had gone too far. And I admitted to him that things had gone too far, but just not with me. And I did say to him that I'm sort of grateful that I wasn't in an hospital bed like Paul Lee was.
Mm.
And when he stopped the tape, he asked me if I'd kicked him or something. I said, well, when the guy had a knife, I kicked out to stop him, but as regards to the stamping, there's nothing to do with me, because that was when it did go too far. Yeah. Even though my life was in danger, it's not something I would have done. So anyway, I see Spencer about 2-3 weeks after the interview. He stopped his car. I sat at the side of the car, and I was dying to ask him about it, but I didn't want to really put him in a position. After 2 minutes small talk, he started telling me that I should start dropping names. Again, I said I felt real grateful that I wasn't in an hospital bed like Paul Lee.
Mm.
And he said to me that they're going to do me for it. So I said to him, you can't do me for something I've not done. And he said, we can. To which, stupidly enough, me thinking he's a friend, I went, I bet you can't. Which I thought was a reasonable thing to say. I bet you can't stitch me up for something I ain't done. We shook hands like a mug. I never realised. He went to court, and it turns out that the Sri Lankan had put a complaint in about him and called him a racist. So he went above and beyond to try and please the Sri Lankan, including stitching me up in court. So when I'm giving evidence, the trial was a farce. The barrister said to me, you're cocking my Mr. Wood, aren't you? I went, why would you say that? He went, well, you bet the police are 5 years that you're going to get away with this.
And I was, oh, he fucking did you on that.
Yeah,
he?
And I was like, whoa, no, I know DC Spencer. I said, that was a bet about me being stitched up. And I said, it was purely because I believe in the justice system. And he stood up and he just shook his head. And I just thought, you're ruthless. B-A-S-T-A-R-T. So anyway, throughout the questioning, he was taking the Sri Lankan and his family outside, going above and beyond. After I got found guilty, a week later, the police raided the Sri Lankan's house, and he was on a suspended sentence for the knife attack. And he's been a fugitive ever since.
Does he, like, is he still around there?
Oh, he is, yeah. But the police don't care. And they don't care. And, I got 5.5 years in prison. I was at uni studying for a degree. And it sort of turned my life upside down.
Yeah, 5.5 years, that's a long time.
First offence as well.
First offence?
Yeah. I mean, him stabbing people and doing what he did, it just wasn't fair. It was a guy called Judge Reddiow. And I've often said if I could take one aspect away from the trial and change it, it was the judge.
Was it?
All of my witnesses said the judge was worse than the prosecution. So I come out of jail. Andy Cox was a senior, and he wanted to go pro. A few things that he did, I refused to work with him on. If you want to know what he did, you can read about it in a book I'm writing.
Yeah.
It was pretty low. I refused to train him. I think he went pro and had 2 fights, won one, lost one, but he won't that good, and that's not me being bitchy. That's pretty much every time that I've seen him, because he's a coach now, and he runs his own gym. Between slagging me off, saying that I shouldn't be coaching, I just read his lies in the paper. I've heard all sorts that Frank Warren was going to promote him. He was going to fight Amir Khan. He's had a 19-0 record, and I just can't believe the Telegraph was just printing his lies. So he's got him places. He's got him his own set up gym down to Tetney Road. He's got a large number base, but me personally, I can't lie to students. You know what I mean? I've got to be honest with them. So anyway, yeah, Kev Hooper turned pro. I decided to help him. I took him to 3 titles. He broke a load of records. And I think Kev got the score that, you know, like an hour down the road at Sheffield, they had more world champions than we did area champions. Mm. So after so many years working with Kev, I felt that I'd done all that I could for him. And I retired, and he went on to box for the English. He won it, and he even went on to box for the British. But he's only just retired, but it was a positive thing, but it was very draining on my part.
Yeah.
And if I was to do it again, no, I wouldn't.
No.
Because I really wanted to help Kev, and I just wanted to leave my past behind. It's never that easy to do that in a town like this.
And does your past still come back to bite you?
Yeah, it
like
does.
Yeah. You've got a reputation because you've been inside and everything, you've been on the doors.
A lot of people do comment that when they get to know me, I'm misunderstood, they're not what I expected. And no, I'm like, well, I can't help what you've heard about me. But, I mean, you must have come across a certain Mr. Phillips, haven't you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's not easy to cook for himself, but to me, the only scenario that I could put around that is life's teaching me lessons I don't want to learn.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? To have somebody obsessed with you over 5 years now, telling everybody that he's attacked you, he's beat you up, and that's not even what happened.
Well, what's the reason for all that? Where did it all
I wasn't sure. His ex-partner contacted me to tell me that he'll stalk me, and he did do that. And it was like the police was encouraging him to do it. He was standing outside my flat. But and when I when my girlfriend moved in with me, it started to affect life. You know what I mean? To have a stalker, it's not a good thing.
Mm.
I mean, if he wants to stand outside my house in the night, crack on with it. I'm in bed. But it was starting to scare her. So it was unbelievable, and I've never come across anything like it. And at the end, I could only put it down to, there's a kid desperate for a reputation. There's a kid desperate to be seen as something he's not. And he was even referring to me at one point as his idol. And if I'm your idol, you need to sort yourself out. Do you see what I'm saying?
It's a bit spooky, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. But yeah, the old prison thing, yeah, it said a secondary and a third, that. But that's not normal.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? If you fall out with someone, I'm all up for going sorting it out. At the end of it, you either shake hands, or you don't, stay away from each other. But to actually go on Facebook day in, day out, talking about an individual, purely to keep a reputation up, that something that hasn't even happened, it's disturbing. And you can tell the kid suffers with mental health, which scares me a lot, because I don't want to encourage anything like suicide or that. So I just stay away from it. But like I say, I don't think that I'd have stalkers if it wasn't for me going to jail for something that I'd not done.
5.5 I mean, how did you deal with that time inside? Is there any, because it's a long time, was it just one prison you were in?
No, they moved me around. I'm not going to say that I'm I was Jimmy Boyle, and you know what I mean, I was doing press ups like in my cell naked, and it was nothing like that. Majority of people that was in jail, I found it was either a moment of madness being lifers that was in for murder, and there was lovely people.
Mm.
There wasn't evil people. Or it was lads that was addicts, and they was in there feeding their habits.
What's it like for an average day inside jail for someone who doesn't know? What's like for an average day? Because the fucking press always put pictures.
Oh, it was front page of the paper. But
I mean, what's it actually like for a proper day inside? Like the food,
the
atmosphere.
Right. Well, when you land, I always thought that it'd be like a very clinical place.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Hull, and you get issued with your clothes, which is very military-like, and they put you in a cell, and there was no windows in the cell. Now, it was December time that I'd gone to jail, so these clothes that I've got that are meant to last me, that I've got like a visiting year clothes, I've had to double up because it's freezing. I can see myself breathe. And I'm thinking to myself, this is Britain, this isn't Poland, this isn't Russia. And it turns out that the UK's prisons are the worst in Europe.
Right.
Yeah, so that was a learning curve. Like, they pay millions upon fines towards the EU for the conditions of our jail. Rather than correct the prisons,
they'll pay the fine.
Yeah, so if you're talking the prisons that are like the Victorian, like Porridge, they're the ones that are in a worse state. Being in jail, it's all about getting into a routine. You find your friends, you find lads that you go through jail with. You're all there for the same reason. Majority of people think when you've gone to jail, you're an animal, you deserve to be in there. The condition should be barbaric because you're a criminal. Mm. And unfortunately, the world's never that black and white. So I went to Hull, I went to the Wolds, I went to Hatfield, which was open.
All right.
Got released, got sent back to jail.
What did you get sent back to jail for?
A little plastic gangster was terrorising a couple, and I tried to help, and it sort of fell on my feet. But
all right.
If you want to know about it, read it in the book.
In the book, yeah.
Basically, like I said, when you get to jail for something like that, you attract a certain type of person. So I come across this person that was a doorman, but 3 foot tall, 3.5 foot because he used to wear these boots. I went round to his house once, and even though he had a wife and kids, he had two staffies called Ronnie and Reggie. So anyway, he actually had that portrait of the Cray twins on his back, to which I was like, oh my god, is this a plastic gangster starter kit or what? So anyway, he had signed photos of Mad Frankie Fraser and stuff like that, and I just thought, oh my god,
living a dream.
Yeah, I just thought, well, I can tell what you want out of life. So anyway, slowly but surely, he was interested in the boxing, and he couldn't box, and he'd come down to the gym, and he was humiliated a bit. Do you know what I mean? I got him to join in with the 10-year-olds because of his size. They were the only lads that he could really spar with. So anyway, at that time, without saying too much, because there's a full chapter that I'm writing about, there was a couple.
I used to go to school with him.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Wow. Well, you know what I mean with the size then, don't you?
Yeah. I know exactly what he's like.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, a few people have said that. They actually call me a bully, which for the first time, I despise the word bully, but I was very flattered them calling me a bully. I thought, I'll own that. I will own that. You calling me a bully, I will own that one. So anyway, a couple that I've purposely not met yet, but I know who they are, was being terrorised. And one of them was pregnant. So I felt I'd do the right thing. Police didn't want to know. And
why didn't the police want to know about that?
I don't know. I contracted a mate called... a mate who worked in security, who worked with the police, and he was the only way I could really liaise, because I never spoke to the police.
Yeah.
They'd ruined my life. They took advantage of my sister's life. Again, you'll have to read that in the book.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to know. And my mate warned me. He said, I know about it, Sean, but he said, I'm warning you, you stay out of it. But me being me, you know, sometimes doing the right thing's not doing the right thing. And some sort of confrontation took place, and then somebody lied, and I ended up going back to jail, to which I landed in Lincoln. But
how long was that for?
I finished the sentence off, which was another year. But I mean, at the time, I didn't think it. I was saying to myself, why don't you mind your own business? But like I say, do you know what I mean? What's the saying? Evil triumphs when good men refuse to do something. Is that the word? I don't know.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I stood by my morals, and I never stood by and watched a pregnant woman get terrorised. So anyway, went back to jail again. It was
what's in the worst jail? Was like Lincoln good compared to Hull? And
I thought Hull was terrible, but it's very similar to Lincoln. Is very similar to Hull,
yeah.
But Lincoln had windows in.
All right.
So, but Lincoln is very much like a porridge jail. If you think of it, like you've got the castle. I mean, there's even the gallows at Hull, at Lincoln.
All right.
So anyway, it was Victorian jail. I was lucky that I met a lad from Grimsby called Jamie Day, a football hooligan, or so-called football hooligan. Don't know what he was doing in jail, because he's an idiot. And I mean that in the nicest possible way, because he's funny. We was banged up together. And while I was in there, I was in the showers. and I was talking to this this guy from Cyprus. When I say showers, there was cubicles.
It's not like the big open ones where you drop the soap.
No. So anyway, I said to him, "Why are you here?" I said, "If I was from Cyprus, I wouldn't be in this dump hole." So anyway, get this. This was the most funniest story that I'd heard in jail. It turned out he was a civil inmate. And
what's a civil inmate?
Yeah, I'll explain to you. He had kids here. And basically, he went up in front of the magistrate, and the magistrate went fully against him. He wasn't allowed to see his kids, he wasn't like this. And he called the magistrate something of a rude nature. So the magistrate said, "Apologise." And he went, "No." And he went, "Right, I'm going to send you down now as a civil inmate. And every 12 weeks that you can come up in front of me, you've got the chance to apologise, or you're going back to prison. Every 12 weeks. You got that?" So I was like, "How long can they keep you for?" He went, "A year." And I went, "Oh, so when's your first 12 weeks up?" He went, "No, I'm finishing it. I've only got 2 more weeks and I've done the year." He went, "I ain't apologising to him." I thought, that is stubbornness 101, that, innit? And I've been like, "Get me back in front of him. I'm sorry."
That's mad, isn't it? Fucking hell. Just say sorry and you can have your life.
So anyway, I just thought, well, you've just shown that magistrate. Over the past 12 months, he's been on 2 holidays. Do you know what I mean? Been in bed with his wife every night. And you've just been in this dump hole.
Was he in Lincoln for all the time?
Yeah, for the 12 weeks. But it was crazy. But that's individuals. And I just thought that individuals are crazy. Now, me, I had a family. I wouldn't have put my family through that for pure stubbornness. I've just been like, these things happen. I apologise. Shouldn't have said that. Yeah. I've been a bit of an idiot, you know. It's one of them things, George, isn't it?
So did you ever any sort of like trouble inside, or was it?
Yeah, that was a cliche. Don't really want to talk about that because it sounds childish. All that I'll say is I was lucky. There was a kid that was on the wing and he was known within the jail as being a bit of a nasty lad.
Yeah.
I won't go as far as to call him Pongo Banks, but he won't foul off it.
I don't know who Pongo Banks
is. You've seen Scum, haven't you?
Yeah.
Scum, Pongo.
Oh, right.
There's a big lad in that bed called Pongo. He knows you're coming.
Right.
So anyway, lucky for me, I got started on. I ignored it. A kid that see it was trying to make me laugh, and he was starting on him, so I had to interfere. All I say that there was something happened to where that fight or that incident stood with me throughout all my sentence.
Right.
And I got left alone quite a lot because of it. Because it's very difficult to be quiet and get on with your own jail, try and stay out of incidents, because the prison is full of bullets. Unfortunately, it is, and it is one of them. Yeah. And so yes, as far as that was concerned. So
I've got to stand your ground then for like the first part to make people show you're not.
It's not that cliche. It's not. To be fair, majority of
this is what people think prison's like, sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I got asked a lot about jail, and I took the mickey a lot about it. I mean, a lot of people talk about homosexuality in there, and like, I never see any of that. It does happen, but I never, thankfully, I never see none of that. And 5.5 years weren't enough to convert me. So, but I...
maybe another half a year would have done.
Yeah, I often wind a lot of people up, and I tell them, I said, oh, my first night, and I walked in, there was this massive 6'7", black heavyweight, and just staring at me. And I said, I started to make my bed, and after about an hour staring at me, he broke silence. And everyone was like, oh, what's he say? And he says, we're going to play mumses and dadses. Which one do you want to be? And I panicked, and I said, oh, I'll be daddy. And he goes, well, I'll come here and suck mummy's cock. Oh. No, sorry, you have to edit that out, right? So anyway, everyone laughs, but a few people are going, what did you do? And I'm like, it was a joke, you moron.
So... when I'm like guessing you'd never go back, you don't want to go back, no one wants to go back into something.
It's not a case of wanting to go back. It's majority of people that are in jail, they don't know better. It's a waste of life. So for someone like me, like, there was a lot of lifers in there that were switched on guy. It was a shame to see him in there, because like I say, it was a moment of madness.
Yeah.
And if I've had certain friends go to jail, they've said, you just stay away from the idiots, because you want to get out of there, and they seem not to want to get out. They seem to be more bothered about the drama that's going on inside, you know, like drugs that have come in the jail, fights that are happening, to where you're just like, ignore
just get
it.
Your head down and
exactly, yeah.
Time. That's it. So when you came out, I know you got a gym on an old scouts up.
Yeah.
You got a boxing gym there. What sort of made you get that one, that location?
Well, at the time, to be fair, maybe it wasn't the right thing to do. But it turned out good. I opened the scouts up. I tried to take some students on. But by that time, Andy Cox had established his own gym. And because I'd been released from jail, and under the circumstances, he decided to take that up on to his advantage, to try and get me stopped opening a gym, which was a bit devious because he wouldn't have even learnt to box if it weren't for me. So he's
in In what way did he try and get you to stop opening a gym?
I shouldn't be working with kids because he knew that I got sent to prison for something that I never did. Even though when I was released, he asked me to turn in pro and I didn't for something that he did that I thought was barbaric. Yeah. It was sickening. Again, you can find out what it is when you read it in my book.
Yeah, we'll talk a bit more about your book in there.
Yeah. And he then took that to his advantage. But what he actually did for me to fall out of him, he was an adult by then. And to me, that was the man that he'd grown into.
Yeah.
So although when they come down to inspect, when the ABA come down to inspect it and they inform me what Mr. Cox was saying, although I thought, ruthless, you won't even be boxing here if you want for me, it didn't surprise me because he scooped lower than doing that to me, what he did to a certain individual. And he's carried on doing it to not just to me, to other clubs. And it's, I think a lot of people have started to see through him now for the man that he is, the person that he is.
Yeah.
And it was just unfortunate that because of my circumstances, I wasn't in a very strong position to stick up for myself. Even though why me and him fell out was me taking the moral high ground. So, can I just take this call?
Yeah, you can do. We'll just pause that and we'll be back soon. And we're back. You just had, we're like actually doing the interview in your gym, aren't we? Your like new gym.
New gym, yeah. Well,
which,
when I left the scout up, when I decided to pack in with Kev, wished him the best. I wanted to go back more to the amateurs.
Mm.
And I wanted to go back more to where it all began rather than the paid ranks.
Yeah.
So I invited the club that I started at the White Hart that was based on the docks. I invited them to move into the scouts up. So they did, and at the same time, that's when my stalker was really full on strong, using Facebook as a media to say lies and hate. So I decided, through certain things that the police was doing.
Were the police, had the police still hounding you? Were they hounding you at that time?
Yeah, big time. That was pretty much the worst that they got to me then. I decided to, if I wasn't working around the kids area, so I had Andy Cox attacking me, I had the police attacking me, making rumours up, and they was fueling Mr. Phillips' Facebook campaign.
Yeah.
I thought I would be in a better position if I was just away from it.
Is he still doing it now then, Mr.
Oh,
Phillips?
Yeah. He'll walk past me in town, say something, I'll ignore him. Next thing, there's a big rant on Facebook that I've said something to him, I'm an has-been, and he went to jail for beating me to a pulp, and he'll do it again if need be, and I'm like, all right, Adam, yeah, okay.
Yeah, because you had an incident over there, didn't you?
What it was. It started that way.
With a knuckle duster.
Yeah, that's right. He hit me with a knuckle duster, and I didn't know he had a knuckle duster on, to which I said to him, he just punched me in the face. So I looked, and my lip was bleeding, and I was like, you've got a knuckle duster on, which was quite comical. But everyone was like, oh, God, you must have an hard head. And I was like, no, I've got an head like anybody else. But luckily for me, he couldn't punch. So he sprinted behind the door at the gym and was holding the door tight until the police come. He was being sick behind the door.
Being sick?
Yeah, he was throwing up, I can't beat you, Sean. I was like, beat me, you've just beat me with a duster, which I'll get my hands on you. I laugh at it, but I did see my ass about it.
Oh, you saw red.
Yeah, I did. I couldn't get to him, but thankfully I couldn't get to him because it wouldn't have ended with whatever. But his version of events then, he decides to message people saying, oh, do you know who I am? I'm the one who punched your mud to a pulp. I've read these messages. What else has he said? Oh, he decided to start on my friend Connor Monument. Now, me and Connor, I have taught him how to box, but because I'm not really a coach anymore, we've become friends.
Yeah.
We banter a lot on Facebook. More of a P-take relationship, yeah? I take the mick out of him being pasty with ginger ale, but the truth is,
not wrong with ginger ale.
No, I'll vouch that. It's just it's jovial banter, but basically, Connor's a freak. He eats like he's got bricks on his hand, and he could have gone pro years ago. So anyway, Phillips decides to home in on him looking pasty and ginger. So anyway, he messages him, but he also indirectly threatens his missus, saying that she's pretty. And he's saying to him, "Why do you idolise a scumbag? Why won't you speak to me, bitch?" That's what he said to him. And then he finished off with saying, "Beth, who's Connor's missus, she's pretty, isn't she?" In other words, an indirect threat. But that's Phillips all over. He's threatened a lot of women. So anyway, Connor's seething. And he's right to be. Do you know what I mean? But Connor's just had a fight with a Marine, and he ended up nearly going to jail for it. So I'm trying to calm Connor down, and I'm saying the kid's an idiot. But the more I say the kid's an idiot, Connor's taking it as though he's a nutcase.
Yeah.
So anyway, the best way that I could get to dissolve it was a mutual friend. Tell that lad, Connor will wipe the floor with him. He might be ginger, he might be pasty, but he's better a boxer than I am. Me.
Yeah.
Because he's a man now, he's not a boy anymore. So anyway, next time I see Connor, he was like, "He's not all there, him, is he?" And I said, "I did tell you that." He went, "I was on the phone to him, he's got the world's worst stutter," going, "I'm so sorry." And I was laughing. And he went, "You know, I can't believe that, he freaked me out." And I was like, "I told you he was an idiot." So obviously I think he realised he'd threatened the wrong kid, so then
it sort of backfired on him.
Yeah, but I think he went for victim mode then, as in like, "I'm so sorry, I'm having a breakdown." And so anyway, it was stuff that we all laughed at. But it was like, I'd finished with Kev, so then I decided to move to this place, and it was a bodybuilding gym down Pasture Street.
I know, it's pretty. You've got some awesome kit in here.
There was a boxing gym upstairs, but I very, very, very rarely use it. Very rarely use it. I don't use it for competition anymore. There's nobody competing here. Do you know what I mean? It's maybe a few friends meet up to do a bit of cardio here, that's why.
Yeah.
So, it's always been like, I've always wanted to work for myself. I've never wanted a job. Like the scout up. I mean, I left the scout up because of a combination of things, Mr. Cox, Mr. Phillips, the police, and lies. But I was living across the road from there, and I remember coming out one day, and you remember the guy that picked me up from the age of 7, Buddy Rayworth. He's retired now. He must be about 90 somewhere. No, not really. He's only about 70 somewhere. But he was doing a bit of DIY there, and I thought it's really good to see that he's retired now. And it's like a project for him. And in a way, it was nice to see that a guy had done for me, done something for me with nothing else. You know, asking for nothing. It was good to see him there. And I've often nipped in, and it's packed with kids.
Yeah.
It was nice to see, so.
That's good. And do you like sort of find this environment a bit better where they just come in and train and
yeah,
go?
This is me now. I'm still tired from the old Kev Hooper experience, and I've sort of been on the back burner with this still, but it's a new year and I'm going for it full force.
So just quickly about your book, because I know you're busy, and thanks for fitting us in. You're writing a book about your life.
Yeah, it's more of a letter, right, than no, because I hear that much stuff about me. Honestly, some of the stuff that I've heard about me, and I'm like, yeah. And like, you know where Chapman's Pond is?
Yeah.
Yeah. What, you ever heard any stories about it?
Bottomless.
Bottomless, yeah. Anything else?
There's the horse and cart down there.
That's the one, yeah, yeah.
Double-decker bus.
That's there as well, yeah.
Like, that's about it. Yeah.
Did you ever hear the one about the plants that sort of pull you down? And
no.
I had that one at school. And if you go on a certain day in the winter when it's foggy, you can hear that horse and cart. You ever heard
can
that
you?
One?
I've heard there's a girl there that drowned. There's a small girl.
I had a little kid drown by it when I... So anyway, the bus never happened, okay? The horse and cart never happened. It was a milk float. And you can still see that because it's not bottomless. It's 10 metres deep. Did you know that?
Someone did say the other day it's only like...
It's 10 metres. Yeah. I've got a friend called Chris Carr. He's a builder. He bought it. So all them rumours that you hear, well, I've heard similar rumours about me. And I'd like to just explain to certain people, especially the ones that have said, "You're not what I expected you to be, Sean."
You're not. I mean, I've known you for, what was I, about 21, 23, it's about maybe 19 years, and you've always been fine. You're a nice lad. But then you hear the rumours, I'm like, well, everyone's got a bit of a different side to them, but...
And people like to talk. People like to talk, and people like to be in the know. And they like to talk like they know the score. I mean, like I said, I've heard that I've never been right since my brother died.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I've never had a brother. And I had a goldfish once that died that I called Rocket. And then I heard that I was working a skid door once, and these gypsies turned him. I knocked one of them out, and it turned out he was a bare-knuckle gypsy. And so they come back for a sort of bare-knuckle sort of, and I put 10 grand, they put 10 grand, and I was like, right. And I was like, that's what happened then. I went, well, there was Brad Pitt taking a dump by the side of the caravan. There was a little dog that kept squeaking by the diamond. And I went, you've been watching too much Nash. No, I have never had a bare-knuckle boxing match in my life. But people just like to talk about it.
Because it's a small town, and people like to take the chance.
There you go.
Obviously, you've got a reputation. And that's it.
So the book was more of a thank you letter to my friends that have took me at face value and not listened to some of the rumours. And I think some of it's quite funny as well, because I've met some right individuals that I've never seen in films. Plus, it's a bit of a thank you letter to my family.
No, I'm guessing it's probably made you a bit of a stronger person doing what you've done, or like been through what you've been through.
It's not been easy, it hasn't. And it's been a lot of down moments. But like I said, I haven't actually started writing it yet. I'm just putting pieces together, and we're just sending it to what do they call them? We've just done the synopsis.
All right.
We're just sending it to an agent for him to advise what sort of company would be interested in this story. So, but like I said, there's nothing nasty in it. If I do talk about someone, I'll state that they're not here to stick up for themselves. This is my opinion.
Yeah.
And I'd like to maybe put a few things straight.
And when's your date looking for it to come out? Is it this year? Well, not this year. 2019.
I'm talking to a writer now. He's been quite funny to work with, because he can't believe some of the stuff that I've said. And he's like, really? What happened there? He was like, and he's shown a lot of interest, and we've laughed about it because. He's actually stopped me and said, do you know how bizarre that sounds? And I've gone, yeah, that is pretty messed up, isn't it? But because I've become desensitized to it, it's been the norm.
Yeah.
And he's actually made me stop and think, wow, that's barmy. And it's been quite interesting.
Right, I'm going to look forward to reading it, and I want a signed copy. Obviously, I'll buy one off you, but if you can sign it for me, that'd be amazing.
Why are you going to buy one? I want double for signing it.
Fine, fair enough. Cheers. But cheers for coming on the Tin Biscuit podcast. It'll be up in a few days, so you can listen to it on iTunes or Podbean and anything like that.
All right, can you send us a copy? Because I really don't go on iTunes.
I will do. We'll get it sorted for you.
All right, Rick. Thanks for coming, pal.
All right. Cheers for that, Sean. Take care.
Cheers, bye-bye. Pal. Bye. Bye.